Weir, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, sir.
Against the city of Colorado Springs. Pardon me. Followed by Mountain States Mutual against Hauser. Our counsel here on the second case.
Yes.
Okay. Terrific. Counsel, we have read the briefs and been into the record in your cases, so you can feel free to proceed directly to argument as opposed to spending time on a rendition of facts. We're aware of those. As you know, you've got 15 minutes aside, and the yellow light comes on when there are 5 minutes left for your argument for purposes of planning rebuttal. I would ask that, and when the red light comes on, that's the end of the road. I'd ask that people in the audience and counsel, to the extent you have cell phones or pagers, please turn those off so we're not interrupted during the argument. And with that request, counsel, you may proceed.
Your Honors, good afternoon. Tim Schutz with the law firm of Haynes and Schutz, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Dorothea Dottie Weir. It is a pleasure and a privilege to be here this afternoon. We appreciate the opportunity to discuss this case with you. I appreciate Judge Graham's reminder that you have been through the briefs and been through the record. And in view of that, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the factual record, but just a couple of brief minutes to sort of frame up the issues for legal discussion. The Weir family obtained the property that's at issue in 1996. At the time, it was improved with a house and a detached garage. It was in generally a rundown condition, and they began the process of cleaning it up and converting it. The garage was in 1997 converted to what is characterized in the record as the accessory dwelling unit. At the time, it was a business, a weaving business, operated by Miss Dottie Weir. It included a bedroom and a bath and a small kitchen. She had people coming in and out of town who would stay there as a part of the business she provided related to her looming business. This is a case that's somewhat difficult to talk about in terms of the definition of the porch and some of the controlling ordinances, just simply because we don't have visual aids, and it was for that reason that we attached some photographs to our opening brief as an appendix. And I will refer to those at times during the course of my presentation. The appendix page 4 illustrates the accessory dwelling unit and the porch as it existed in an unenclosed format. The porch is more than 50 feet from the rear lot line, and it is about 180 square feet in its total, and that was true both before and after its enclosure. The Mr. Weir passes away in 2004, financial crisis for the family, and Mrs. Weir decides to move into the accessory dwelling unit and decides to rent out her house. The dilemma she's faced with is she doesn't have room for her loom, and the solution to that dilemma is to enclose the porch so that she can locate this large loom at that spot. That begins in 2007. In March of 2007, she receives a cease and desist order from the city. And the city says either tear down the porch that has been enclosed at this point or seek a variance. She works with city staff pursuing the variance angle, pays the $625 filing fee, and things are proceeding smoothly at that point, and a favorable result is anticipated. But somewhere during this course, planning takes a more adversarial position and eventually impose the condition of waiving the 5 yards setback from the side lot line if she would agree to tear down the porch. She declines that offer. Case eventually goes to a public hearing before the city council. City council denies the 3 variances. We then appeal the matter to the trial court and file a declaratory judgment action asking for a declaration that the porch is not, or excuse me, that the structure qualifies as a porch and therefore not included in the rear yard lot envelope or the 750 square foot limitation. The trial court, of course, denies that relief, and we are here. We believe that the central issue is this: did the trial court err as a matter of law in concluding the addition does not meet the definition of a porch? If the answer to that is yes, we believe that that is dispositive of the case, because if the structure does fall within the definition of a porch, then no variance was necessary, either to make the 750-square-foot limitation or the rear yard setback. So the starting point, of course, in terms of the legal issues is what is the definition or what is the ordinance that defines the square footage limitation? And that is set forth in our brief 7.3.105, which says the maximum footprint or finished living area of a detached accessory dwelling unit may not exceed 750 square feet. Then, importantly, decks and or porches attached to an accessory dwelling unit are not included in this calculation.
Mr. Schutz, let me ask you a question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Sort of procedurally, is the basis of your appeal your declaratory judgment action, where you're asking that we rule that the structure qualifies as a porch, or is it the appeal of your 106A4 action, where we would then have a different standard of review?
Question is well taken. The answer to the first question is that's where we think the case falls, and it's the primary area of our appeal, and that is that we are appealing the denial of the declaratory judgment action, and we think the standard of review on that is a de novo standard of review, because you're asking to being asked to interpret as a matter of law an ordinance. We do have a 106 aspect of this, and it's sort of a fallback position. In other words, if the court says that it believes the structure does not meet the definition of a porch, we believe that there was an abuse of discretion still in terms of the 106 claim. But I think the important issue and the dispositive issue is the definition of a porch. And again, as I say, we believe that's reviewed on a de novo basis. A porch is defined as a first-story structural projection on the front side or rear of a building which may or may not have a roof. It is a very simple definition under the Colorado Springs Code. We cited the Hartley versus City of Colorado Springs decision, and there's many other cases that stand for the same proposition, that in interpreting an ordinance, any ambiguities are to be resolved in favor of the property owner's right to the free use of their property. That's both constitutionally based and based on the fact that zoning ordinances are in derogation of the common law. The city admits or acknowledges that the porch as it existed prior to the enclosure and shown on the photographs met the definition of a porch under the code. It's a first-story structural projection on the front, side, or rear of a building, in this case, the accessory dwelling unit. It has a roof. City argues that the enclosure of the porch removes the structure from the definition of a porch, and we think that's where the error is. It's not supported by the language of the ordinance. Both before and after its enclosure, this structure met the definition of a porch. It's a first-story structural projection on the front, rear, or side of an accessory dwelling unit with a roof.
Did it have walls before it was enclosed? I take it not.
It did not. It did not.
It was just a roof and a porch.
And pillars. It was a roof on a slab on grade, supported by pillars.
Then it was enclosed with walls.
That's correct.
Electricity was added?
No, electricity existed prior to. The exterior side of the, or the, there were lights out on the porch as it existed prior to its enclosure.
Heat was added?
No. I think there was a vent put in to reach the
to take
unit.
The heat out to the porch.
Yes, to push the
and
push
insulation.
Up. Pardon me.
And insulation on the walls.
No. There would be insulation, I think, on the exterior walls. There's some dispute in the record, and what I was focusing on Judge Hoffman was, or excuse me, Judge Graham, is the wall that existed prior to enclosure. There was no structural change made to that, no addition of insulation.
Mr. Schutz, if you wouldn't mind me interrupting the flow of your argument, I've got a housekeeping question for
yes,
you.
Yes, Your Honor.
In your notice of appeal, you say that Ms. Weir is appealing the trial court's order dated June 26, 2008, and attach a copy of that order to the notice. That order says in the clearest of terms that this matter is presently before the court on appeal pursuant to CRCP 106A4 and upon plaintiff's request for equitable relief in form of a declaratory judgment. However, it appears that the court actually decides the case on the basis of 106. Would you agree with that?
I don't agree with that. I think there were two separate claims for relief, Your Honor, that were articulated in the complaint. They were separately denominated as two separate claims for relief, one claim for declaratory judgment, a separate and independent claim for a Rule 106 review.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah. A couple of things in terms of this characterization as a porch and the basis for the conclusion that it is and remains a porch. The city, during the enforcement part of this, there was a letter from the zoning enforcement officer, and she sends this letter at the time that the porch is near completion. It's been enclosed, and she twice in that letter characterizes the structure as a porch. It's not, I wouldn't say, in the nature of a judicial admission, certainly, but I would say that it is a very salient factor because it's prior to the formation of these issues and prior to the posturing that goes on in terms of the legal argument subsequent to that. It's just the zoning code enforcement officer acknowledging and characterizing this as a porch, and we think that's an important admission. The argument that is made by the city, we believe, is premised on an error of logic. What the city, we have not seen at any point the city argue that the structure doesn't meet the definition of a porch after its enclosure. Rather, what we think the city is arguing is that it meets the definition of a building under the code. And we think that's an erroneous reasoning, erroneous legal argument. The argument goes something like this: since the structure meets the definition arguably of a building, even though it meets the definition of a porch, it can't be considered a porch. And the key point from our perspective is, does this meet the definition of a porch? Whether it meets also the definition of a building is irrelevant. We use the analogy to bath facilities in our brief. Bath facilities is a defined term, so are kitchen facilities under the city's ordinance. And certainly those structures also meet the definition of a building. Building definition is very broad under the city's code. It's any structure having a roof supported by columns or walls for the housing or enclosure of persons, property, or animals. Point being that the code breaks down these various subcomponents of a building: bath facilities, kitchen facilities, a porch. And the operative question here is not whether it may meet the definition of a building. The operative question is, does it meet the definition of a porch? And this unquestionably does. One other point.
If it meets the definition of a building, why can't the city require a permit? If the conversion of it to a different type of structure meets the definition of a building, can't the city require permits be obtained?
I mean, absolutely, Your Honor. And that's,
it was, as I understand what you told me, it was a roof, columns, and a slab, and then they added walls, and the difference between the definitions that a building is a roof supported by columns or walls. It didn't have walls before when it was clearly a porch, and now it has walls, and they call it a building.
It was supported by columns before.
But now it has walls.
Right.
And that's
another... but the definition before or after, whether it was enclosed or not enclosed, it meets the definition of a building. When it was just supported by columns, as it was prior to the enclosure, it meets the definition of a building as well.
Well, for the housing or enclosure of persons.
Or personal property. Yeah.
And how was it an enclosure of personal property? She kept her room out there.
Yes. All of us, and not just on this case, but in, you know, a common vernacular. A porch is used for personal property, a grill, a patio furniture, all of those kinds of things. I do want to comment on the point that is implicit in your question, and it was part of the reasoning of the trial court that I think is important. Judge Cain reasoned that that it was important to construe this as a building because that would allow for building code enforcement, and kind of consistent with the point you were making, Judge Richmond. What I think is important is, we are not contesting that this is subject to building code. There's no dispute that we have to pull a building permit. We have been trying to do that. Can't do that unless and until the alleged code violation or variance is granted. Can't pull a building permit to fix the problem at this point until the city either signs off on a variance or we get a declaratory judgment that it is not necessary to get the variance. The important point that I want to emphasize is it's not our position, never has been our position, and we think the code's abundantly clear that it is necessary to pull a building permit in order to do this work, irrespective of whether or not it's characterized as a porch or not characterized as a porch.
Counsel, I know you're running out of time. I have one question.
Yes, sir.
As to the other side of the case, the Rule 106 side, who has the burden of proof to show whether this structure is entitled to a variance, the city or your client?
Our client.
Did she make any kind of showing below that those three criteria of the statute were met, that this is an unusual structure, that there's a, it's a ravine or something that prohibits her use or whatever they argue?
Yes, I think we do. I would acknowledge, however, that our case is steeper on a Rule 106 review. For one, your standard of review, as you well know, is significantly more deferential. And I think we did present evidence addressed to the uniqueness of the property, the uniqueness of the circumstances. I would acknowledge that other evidence in dispute of that was also presented, but that being said, I think there was sufficient evidence for a tribunal to conclude that each of the elements of the variance have been met. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the Rule 106 claim, and I don't have much time to spend on it, but I would just refer you to our briefs. Our arguments there are that we were prejudiced by evidence that was not relevant material that we had asked to be excluded, that the city declined to exclude. And that the rationale that is asking for the relief after the fact was the reason for the denial of this. In other words, that this would encourage people to come in after the fact and ask for a variance, and we can't do that, runs contrary to the code, which permits somebody to come in after the fact and apply for nonconforming use. I can see I'm out of time, and I won't have any rebuttal time unless the court wants me to address anything. So thank you for your time.
All right, Mr. Schultz.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Tom Marisi. I represent the City of Colorado Springs, registration number 15138. I believe that we probably have to start off with how this case should be properly characterized, because I think it's just a 106 action purely and simply. That is the way the trial court dealt with it, and that was dealt with correctly. Really what issue under Rule 106 is whether there was an abuse of discretion when City Council ruled upholding Planning Commission's denial of the non-use variance. So City Council's decision is the quasi-judicial action that was the subject of the 106 case. Part of City Council's determination was accepting Planning Commission's recommendation that this room addition, really is what it is, be defined as a building and fall under the definition of building. So that's one of City Council's decisions that I think is being appealed under the Rule 106 case. And of course, it's very important because of the standard of review in a 106 case.
Although, Mr. Marisi, as Mr. Schutz pointed out, the order in this case does contain a Roman numeral 2 section, which states, and I quote, "This court reviews plaintiff's declaratory judgment claim de novo." And in that section, it does appear that the trial court determined as a matter of law that the disputed structure was a building for purposes of the Municipal Code Section 72201.
Yes, and Your Honor, though, I think that really that it's improper for there be an attempt to file a declaratory judgment action with the 106 action. I think the 106 action actually prevails, and that the declaratory judgment action is an improper use of that action to try to get around the standard of review in a 106. So I think that 106 kind of, it is already spoken for this area.
However, the city did not file a cross appeal with regard to the trial court's entry of a judgment or an order under a declaratory judgment action, did it?
That's correct.
Well, Mr. Marisi, I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but what I seem to interpret, discern from what you say, is that what happened here is that the the agency actually makes the determination that finds itself duplicated in a deck action.
Correct.
And so you're left with the question of which is which.
Right.
You've got a proceeding that is mirrored on both sides.
Yes.
But it proceeds both as a 106 review and as a declaratory judgment.
That's correct.
You agree that if this was a porch and not a building, the variances would not have been required?
I would agree with that.
So it's just that the court had entered the declaratory judgment that the plaintiff was seeking, that would have ended the case right there. It wouldn't have had to go to the Rule 106 analysis.
That's correct, but I think that that would have given the city grounds for appeal based on the fact that it was should have been handled as a 106 action.
Okay.
Right. As I'm arguing it is, that it should be handled as a 106, the standard of review is quite favorable for the city in that the case law holds that a court is not to reweigh evidence or substitute its opinion for that of city council if there is any competent evidence in the record to support the decision. So therefore, what we believe that the sole issue is there competent evidence to support city council's decision upholding planning commission's denial of the non-use variance. No competent evidence under Colorado case law means the ultimate decision of the administrative body is so devoid of evidentiary support that it can only be explained as being arbitrary and capricious. In addition, what we believe is the law in regard to standard of review that is important is the city's interpretation of its own zoning code is to be given deference by a reviewing court. Of course, you can see why an attorney in my position never gets tired of hearing that standard of review. Now, in regard to counsel for Ms. Weir arguing that the Hartley case somehow changes that standard of review, that's just not the case. The Hartley case does not apply to a Rule 106 action, and when you look at the Hartley case, it says zoning provisions allowing non-conforming uses should be strictly construed, and provisions which restrict non-conforming uses should be liberally construed. So really, even by the case that they're citing, that the appellant is citing, the ordinances in this case should be liberally construed because they were the basis of denying a non-conforming use. This case, the Hartley case, talks about how non-conforming uses in general are deleterious to a neighborhood. Now, in this particular case, just in regard to both issues are very good, but kind of the one that's fun to talk about is whether this is a porch or not. And the pictures are probably the best thing in the record to look for to that. There's one in particular that's very important at the record, page 16, shows an outside version and the only photograph we have of the inside of this room addition. And what this shows is that the room has an interior finish. There are windows there. That it looks like the walls were constructed with framing, siding. Most likely there was insulation in there. There was permanent windows. The windows comprise, just a smaller portion of the wall structure than the wall itself. There's the loom apparently is stored in this area. There's things like vases and flowers. This looks, smells, has every indication of being a room. On the outside, you see that it's been constructed so that the siding matches the siding of the original structure. And that is in the record pages 122 and 123, where you see outside pictures of the addition. And again, what we've got is permanent windows, siding matching the siding of the original structure. We don't see anything like sliding glass doors or temporary walls that could be pushed aside. No. In fact, there's no sliding glass door at all. There is an addition of a door that has a lock and is, looks like your regular exterior door. So if I owned this house and I had guests and I said, let's step out onto the porch, what we would really do is just step from one interior room into the other. And that's all we would do. My guests would think I perhaps have lost my marbles, or that I'm such a city boy, I think that a porch is just the room closest to the backyard. And that's not the case. Everything about the appearance of this and the way this has been built transformed the porch into an element of the building. As city staff was saying, an integral part of the living space, not readily differentiated. And really by the admissions of Ms. Weir and her council, was built for the purpose of putting together, storing personal property like the loom.
Well, excuse me, Mr.
Yes.
Marisi.
Marisi, yes, Your Honor.
The way I understand Mr. Schutz's argument is that he's looking at the code definition of a porch rather than the common or generally understood definition of a porch.
Yes, Your Honor.
And my question is, if we had the same structure that you've just described, that has walls and windows and a door, and, but it doesn't have electricity, it doesn't have insulation, is there any structure like that that could be a porch, considered a porch?
Your Honor, if it's, I believe that the key would be whether it was built intending to house property or people. And in this particular case, the elements that were constructed were for that purpose. Whether a porch could be screened in and still be a porch, that is possible. But it wasn't anything, the reconstruction wasn't so light, it was extensive.
Was it Mr. Schutz has said that there was electrical power to the exterior of the building when the porch was open. Was that electrical power extended into the addition? Do you know?
We don't know. And again, one of the reasons is that building permits weren't pulled for this. So we didn't have regional building out there doing any inspections. I think that presumably the electricity that was out there may have been a regular porch light outside of your back door, and that most likely I would think had to be extended to the center of the new room. But we don't know that. Again, don't have the inspections or the ability really to go in and photograph the inside. So that's why the one picture is so important. In regard to that, all I can say is that it may still fall, even after it's constructed, fall under that broad definition of porch, but there's a more specific definition that just makes a lot more sense. And I think what you have to do is go just use the legal principle, even that the more specific definition is the one really that applies, as opposed to some just broad definition.
You agree that this could be both a building and a porch? Plaintiff's counsel argues.
Well, actually, no, I don't, because of the facts of this particular case, the way this construction was done, and the reason of its, the purpose of its construction, admittedly, which was for the housing of the loom and, you know, for greater economic use of the property, ultimately.
But it says it housed the loom even when it was a porch by your own admission. The loom was already out there.
Right. That a person can put things out on their porch, but when they enclose the porch and give it an interior finish and permanent walls and matching siding, well, then it becomes a room. So it really is irrelevant if the porch was or the loom was out there before. Now, just in regard to going over the part about was there competent evidence to support City Council's decision to deny or approve the denial of the non-use variances, the three considerations are, does the property have extraordinary physical conditions that do not generally exist in nearby properties? And Judge Richman was correct in that an example of that would be something like a ravine or some physical characteristic. That it could be the size, shape, location, topography, soils, something like that. Under the guidelines in the city's ordinances, it cannot be the size or location of existing buildings if a self-imposed condition. In this particular case, Planning Commission found and City Council accepted that it was a self-imposed condition to build, to transform the porch into an interior room, thereby bringing it into violation of two areas of the code, which was too many square feet for an accessory dwelling unit, and now counting the former porch, now interior room, as part of the footprint of the accessory dwelling unit. It exceeded the setback or the requirement as to where that structure had to be built. Now, the second consideration or criteria in regard to whether a non-use variance could be granted is such extraordinary physical condition of the property will not allow a reasonable use of the property in its current zone absent relief. The guidelines under this say that the demonstrated extraordinary conditions must directly relate to the inability to reasonably use the property. First of all, there hasn't been a demonstrated extraordinary condition, but a less reasonable use may be proved by evidence that property has less reasonable use by comparison with similar properties in the same zoning district. And there was evidence in the record that city staff, planning staff, looked around the neighborhood and said that the use that Ms. Ware was enjoying prior to the addition was the same type of use being enjoyed by her neighbors. So she wasn't experiencing a less reasonable use of the property. And the desire for, under the guidelines again, the desire for greater economic return is not by itself evidence of not having reasonable use. And self, and then the big one again, self-imposed conditions do not constitute evidence of no reasonable use. And lastly, the third criteria for the granting of a non-use variance would be the granting of the variance would not have an adverse impact around the, upon the surrounding properties. And I see that my time has run out, but I believe if I could just finish up that the evidence, the record does contain evidence regarding the neighborhood association and neighbors being concerned about an do first, ask permission later type of atmosphere, and the fact that one neighbor came in, and it was actually a very human part of the whole proceeding when she said, I hate being here, having to be in a negative position with my neighbor, but I went through the rules, I requested a variance, was denied, and so if she does gets the variance after not following the rules, I really feel let down. Thank you very much for your attention. Is there anything that I can answer at this point?
Thank you, Mr. Morisi.
Thank you.
Mr. Schutz, we let Mr. Morisi run on there a bit. Why don't you take a minute to wrap up?
The one issue that I think would be well to address is the whole declaratory judgment versus the 106 claim. The point I'd like to bring to the court's attention in the record, there was actually a motion to dismiss filed, if my memory serves me, by the city. And that motion to dismiss was grounded on the notion that a 106 claim was improper, that the declaratory judgment claim was improper. That motion to dismiss was denied by the court, and we were allowed to pursue both claims. So I think at this point, the city is precluded from arguing that the 106 claim, that the declaratory judgment claim cannot be brought. I don't have anything else, and I want to be sensitive to the court's calendar. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to try and address those.
Thank you, Mr. Schutz.
Thank you.
Thank
Appreciate
you, Mr. Morisi. Again, thanks both counsel for their good arguments. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.
Thank you very much.